All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome again to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. You may know Glenn Fleischman from a bunch of places, really. He has written for everyone from Wired to Fortune, Popular Science, The New York Times, PC World, and contributes regularly to The Economist, The Seattle Times, Macworld, etc. And also in the last few years, he was the publisher of The Magazine, that iPad publication that we spoke to Chris Higgins about in previous episodes. He also hosted a very popular podcast called The New Disruptors. But for a brief period of time in the 1990s, Glenn was also the catalog manager for Amazon.com right around the time of the site launch. Not only was Glenn able to give us the details on some of the early decisions and processes at Amazon, but he also goes into a frank assessment of Amazon's strategy, what the prospects for the company looked like at the time, and even Jeff Bezos himself. Special thanks to Chris Higgins for research and editorial on this episode. Continuing our Amazon series, here is Glenn Fleischman. Glenn Fleischman, thanks for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So I'd like to start with... I usually start with degrees and colleges and things like that. And you got a graphic design degree from Yale?
That's right. I'm an art major with a concentration in graphic design, because that's, of course, what you go to Yale for, is to get an art degree.
Well, I bring that up because I wanted to lead into, I've been told that you like to tell people that you've been around so long, you still know how to typeset.
Yeah, this is sort of both a joke. It's become a recurring thing because I forgot that I say it so often. It's one of the last people trained formally as a typesetter, I think. Like, not last, like literally number, you know, million or whatever. But I got trained in high school in 1984 or 5 to typeset. We were using digital optical typesetting equipment, which was pretty cool. It was this transition period just before the Mac came out and desktop publishing started, and I typeset the paper. I got paid, in fact, in high school, which was awesome. And but right around that time, there was sort of no reason, by the mid-80s, no one was getting trained as a typesetter. I didn't get trained in lead, in hot lead typesetting, but I did that, and I worked on in summer jobs, and I worked at the printing service at my college, and that's kind of how I made the money I needed to go to college, or part of the money I needed to go to college, was as a typesetter. So I always say that because it comes from, it's typesetting was a kind of programming on the optical digital systems, used a version of code that was sort of like SGML, which is kind of the basis for HTML or similar evolution. So back in 1984, I was writing something like SGML. So when I saw HTML, I'm like, I know what this is. I've been doing this for years already.
Well, and also, so you're saying that exactly in your schooling is really the transition to digital publishing and digital design and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I started with this, you know, this crazy, it's also like this wonderful thing, because optical digital typesetting had a rapidly spinning drum, and you put a film strip on it with the negative space was the shape of letters and characters, and it would expose a light at a precise interval to expose resin coated paper, and then you'd develop it like you're developing film, and it's a lithographic paper. It only exposed black and white. It didn't have any shades of gray, and it's this crazy thing. Then you put wax on the back, you'd run it through a waxing machine, you'd cut it up, and that was what I did, you know, I was mostly typesetting, then moved into design, so 84, 85, 86, and then, you know, 86 comes along, and it's like, well, we don't need to do any of this. What are we doing all this crazy cutting for? And then Linotype and others came out with image setters, which you could set entire pages on from PageMaker and Quark, and then suddenly you start printing onto film directly, negative lithographic film that gets used to make plates for printing, and you know, this is even before any kind of high volume printing. Then we get print on demand even by the late 80s from photocopy machines, and suddenly all the need for this analog stage doesn't entirely disappear, but it's mostly gone within a 5-year period, maybe four, where I had started in and then got my degree and then worked in the field a little bit.
Right. I went to film school in the mid 90s, and they still insisted that we learn to splice film manually.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I at least learned how to do it, but then never actually applied it for anything meaningful.
Hand skills are great, though. I'm glad I got my hand skills. My graphic design courses, we were using ruling pens, and we had to learn great. You get great hand-eye coordination. I used to be able to draw straight lines freehand. I used to be able to tell anything under 12 inches. I could tell you nearly, maybe to the quarter inch, what the distance was by looking at it. And that was a skill. It was a byproduct of doing all the layout, but that creates an enormously strong eye-hand connection. I feel like even today I preserve that. When I look at things digitally, I have a palpable feel associated with it. And I think it helps.
Right, for the real world, what it really is, and
yeah,
spatially even. So let's talk about the technical stuff. Like, I had also heard that you were an early CompuServe guy, big on CompuServe.
Yeah, when I was 11 or so, they had a dial-up thing where you could dial up in their off hours, or their regular hours were expensive and used for timeshare purposes. And their off hours, they ran CB, Citizens Band, right? It was you could do chat and you could do various kinds of little computing tasks and whatever. And I did that, and I ran up way too big a bill, which I think Chris Higgins, our mutual friend, did as well. And so that was short-lived. Couldn't afford to be on the service. It was ridiculously expensive, but yeah, that was 1980 at a 300,
wow,
at 110 baud modem, 110 baud acoustically coupled modem at one point, where you put the handset in and it connects up. And I think at some point I got a 300 baud one. It was very exciting.
I know that they had the CB program really early on. Like, literally, that was one of the first chat applications. But what else did they have in 1980? Were there message boards and things at that point still?
Yeah, there were message boards. There were some programs you could run. I think you could write. I don't know if they had a BASIC, but I remember being able to write a little bit of software, but it was expensive to run. They would charge you for compute time. So even in the off hours, you'd be like, this took, you know, 0.0007 units, and it's $1.50 or something. So... And the dollar was strong still in 1979, despite inflation. So 1980, yeah. So it was real money back then. But it was mostly chatting, forums, and things like that, and a little bit of other stuff.
So what about the web? When do you remember the first time you ever encountered the web, got on it, that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. It's actually a funny story is that I was working for a small book publisher, actually a book packager that did all their books for it was so independent. Like almost like a imprint of a larger publisher, but it was completely independently run and owned, called Open House, and all the books were done for Peach Pit Press, which is now owned by Pearson. And my boss, who's a super forward thinking person named Steve Roth, and he had this hilarious. He's telling me databases, my son. Databases are the future, is what he's telling me in '93.
Like plastics, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It was perfect. '92, '93. He's like, databases. You need to work with databases. Like, oh, databases are boring. No, Dad, I don't want to work with databases. And he turned out to be totally right. Like, he understood that being able to manipulate and process large amounts of information would actually be a big chunk of what would happen in the future. And he did quite a lot with like FileMaker and things like that. And so one day we're looking at Mac Week magazine. I think it was February of 1993 is what I want to say, because I think that's right, or March. And there's a tiny screen capture, maybe like 1 inch by 2 inch of this screen. And it's about, oh, the folks at NCSA have made this program called Mosaic. And it lets you browse a graphical web, which is something that they're working on in Switzerland or something like that. And it was a little vague, but it was, I remember like a little third of a page article. And we got Mac Week was this thing. You know, you get it. Everybody who got it was delighted because it was a weekly publication about the Mac. It was circulation audited. So you had to qualify or pay hundreds of dollars a year if you didn't qualify for their demographics. And we looked at this thing. And Steve, I don't think I saw the potential immediately. I think he said, oh, that's the future. That's it. Like, that's what wins. And I don't remember his exact words, but he really was like, yeah, that's where everything's going to go because graphical interaction and blah, blah, blah. And, he, you know, I was like, well, I don't know. The infrastructure, I think by then I had an internet account. I had internet access in college, at ARPANET access in a class, and I had BitNet and some other internet-connected precursor network access. And I was on the well in, I think it was 89 to 91 because they had a gateway to internet email. But I also participated not heavily in the well community. And then as soon as I could, I got a real dial-up account with, you know, on an internet provider in the early 90s. And so, you know, I saw this thing. I'm like, wow, the network's pretty slow. And I don't know. Do you think they'll actually be able to move graphics? Seems like a long time. And you know, sure enough, that was it. But so the funny part is that was early spring, maybe February or March. I think March of 93. And by June, I'd started a web development company.
Right. So because you're like, well, this HTML is sort of what I've already been, I understand that. And when you see the web taking off, so that's why you're like, all right, I'll jump right on board, right?
Yeah, I started messing around with it. Well, I think the Mac version of Mosaic or some Mac port came out shortly after because that was the X Windows version.
Right, was the first one, yeah.
Yeah, Unix-based or whatever. I guess it was probably BSD. I don't know. One of the Unix flavors had X Windowing system as a graphical, you know, really crummy but, you know, GUI for Unix. And that's what we saw in Mac Week. And then they came out with the Mac version that was super primitive, but it worked. And I... my boss was out of town for a month. He went to France for a month. And, you know, I think I had a relatively light amount of stuff on my plate. And Peach Pit Press was curious about it. So they flew me down from Seattle to Berkeley. And I showed them, I mocked up, like, what a website could look like. And they were just completely fascinated. And they were interested in actually paying money to have something like that created. And they had, I don't know, like an ISDN line at the office. They were zooming along at high speeds, you know, 56K or whatever, 64K. So that led to a few things. I had a fellow I'd worked with at the Codex Center for Creative Imaging. He was an intern, a computer science student and a programmer. And he was thinking about what he was going to do after college. And he and I talked, and we decided to start this company with essentially no money, some credit cards. And his father owned a printing company and had different clients. One of them was Fawcett Outlet. And they were interested in getting in early. Peach Pit Press signed on, and his uncle, my friend Todd's uncle, owned what at the time was the owner of Atlas Model Railroad Company. So we had three clients, and I want to say they were each paying us $5,000 a month. And that was enough to sort of get him out and feed and clothe us and pay the debt and get a T1 line and get some office space, and it was nuts. So we started, and within a few months, we had some of the first commercial websites on the internet in, wait, am I saying 93? I think it was 93.
Probably.
Well, no, it was 94. It was 94 because 93 is when I moved to Seattle. So 94, by June of 94, I started the company, and I think by August or September, because the NSF, the National Science Foundation, had made a change in the rules. Mm-hmm. They were getting out of the internet backbone business, but as long as they were in place, you technically couldn't do commercial stuff, even
right,
though people
right.
were. And I think it was that spring, it was somewhere around then, they opened up the floodgates and said, you know, basically all the commercial restrictions are off, but you still have to find a provider to connect to. And at the same time in Seattle, several companies were starting up. Some existed like UUNet, that had service all over the place, and they wanted $6,000 a month for a 1.5 megabit per second T1 line. And we found a company that was a startup. They figured out how to do everything much cheaper, and they were $1,500 a month. So that's how we were able to go into business. If those guys hadn't started, we would not have been able to afford the service for, you know, another year probably.
I know you mentioned it, but we sort of glided right past it, and I don't want to. So who were your early clients that are coming to you and saying, hey, we need a web presence in 1994?
Well, this is so it was all sort of friends and family, right? So Atlas was Todd's. So Todd was my partner, Todd Heydrich. And Todd Heydrich, you can find him quoted that fall in the Netscape 1.0 press release, because we were so important as a tiny, tiny company with almost no revenue in Seattle. Todd is quoted as a principal at Point of Presence Company in the release for Netscape 1.0. And I love that. So Todd's uncle, Atlas Model Railroad, he had a lot of really geeky people buying model railroad stuff. So the internet was a perfect fit. Even that early, he figured he'd, you know, stake some ground. Peachpit Press published computer books, and they knew they had an audience that was geeky enough, was already even asking about internet purchasing.
Right, sure.
It was via email. And some people, you know, at that time, people were selling stuff via email. You'd send a credit card number and you'd buy things. Powell's Books had a Telnet based purchasing system, their technical bookstore, in, I want to say, 93, maybe 94. You could log in via Telnet and buy books. Our third client was Fawcett Outlet, which was one of Todd's father's printing business's clients. And that eventually led to something else as well that we were involved in. But they thought there'd be, again, an audience of people like sort of professional techie enough that they would want to, that they would figure out how to use this thing. And they wanted to be ahead of the curve. They had a catalog, wasn't very much money relative to their revenue, and they were just interested in experimenting with it because they thought it might go somewhere.
And you guys didn't, there weren't any design clients at that time, right? You guys are basically just hand coding everything you're doing, right?
Yeah, we did the design. Sometimes the sites would, or the clients would produce, graphics and things, or sometimes we would. Both of us had enough of a design background, we could create things. And everything was pretty primitive, and we were trying to compress GIFs as small as possible, use the fewest number of colors in a GIF to make it as tiny as possible. And that became more difficult because I think after a few months in business, we signed up Photodisc, which was a royalty-free CD-ROM-based licensing group that was nearby us in downtown Seattle. And we got office space in downtown Seattle about 8 months, 7 months after we started, I think about March of 1995, I think it was. And what was hilarious is while we're signing the lease, the landlord wanted to give us a 5-year lease, and they were going to give us 2 months of rent abatement, which is, just sort of this sugar to sign a longer lease. Mm-hmm. Before we signed, they said, I actually want to sign a 3-year lease. We'll give you 4 months. We're like, 4 months free rent? We love that. That sounds great. But the reason was the real estate market was just about to heat up. So we had Class A office space, a terrific spot in downtown, not a huge amount of space. And eventually another company that became All Recipes emerged out of our space too, because we sublet to some other people. And film.com, which got acquired by Real Networks, mm-hmm. also we incubated in our space, as it were. It was just, we were right on the verge of Seattle starting to explode. And the real estate company that owned these buildings understood that. And sure enough, within 3 years, like every bit of downtown space was essentially full, and they were able to charge much higher lease. They didn't want to be committed to a long lease. So we were downtown and we started picking up clients. Pacific Coast Feather Company was another early client. I think we had by early 95. And that's the Hanauer family in Seattle. And Nick Hanauer, you may know the name. Nick was one of the people who then went on to help Jeff Bezos raise the first $1 million for Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Nick is now some kind of billionaire who writes about why he should be taxed more. Mm-hmm. because how he's not a job creator. He's a very funny guy. So that was all going on. I can't remember all of our early clients, but Pacific Coast Feather was, they were a big local company. Photodisc was a nice, sizable, very successful local company, and they needed many more images. So we had to deal with, and we needed some database stuff written. We started to go down that path.
And how many years did Point of Presence run for?
Well, it's tricky. I want to say it was 94. That's right. Summer of 94. And I left for Amazon I sold it and left. So Todd had gone off before that point. He was still, I bought him out and he wanted to go to work. He was from the East Coast. He decided to move back after a year. And he went to work for Fawcett Outlet's sort of parent company, which they built this thing called build.com, which was like a set of different building related things run by the same guy who owned Fawcett Outlet. I don't know where that went, actually. I've forgotten. But so he worked for them for a while and then went into other e-commerce and e-commerce stuff. Mm-hmm. So I owned the company and was paying part of Todd out over time. And then I sold it to a friend of mine who was a pretty technical guy looking for something new. And he ran it sort of funny because he ran it for years. And it sort of petered out because he wound up eventually, the market became, when you go from being able to charge $5,000 a month to, $100 a month, it's a mugs business. You have to be a different operation. So he did well with what he did, and he ran clients, got some new ones. And then at some point he realized it was a part-time thing and he needed a full-time job. And All Recipes at that point had been growing and growing, and I think he had some space with them. They eventually became a fairly enormous company and got acquired by the Reader's Digest company, and then sort of reverse merged. Reader's Digest fell on hard times, and the CEO of All Recipes, as I understand it, wound up being, I think, becoming the chief executive of Reader's Digest after that. So they had this kind of interesting arc, and they're still located in Seattle, but we gave them some space and bandwidth and so forth, and they got bigger, Popco got smaller, and Scotty, who I sold it to, he didn't technically shut it down, but I think he sort of petered the clients out, maybe into the, gosh, I'm sort of forgetting, maybe the early 2000s. He is still running some stuff for people, but I think he was basically full-time. He went to work for All Recipes, and then for other more technical IT companies after that, but I think it only had a lifetime, maybe 5 or 6 years when it had active clients, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, then let's transition to Amazon then. Did you participate in the Amazon beta test?
Yeah, I was a early customer. In fact, I don't know if I still have them. I have some receipts of books that were like hand-packed by Jeff Bezos. And the deal was I had a roommate. Well, I was renting a house in Seattle, which I now own. I was renting part of a house, and the guy who owned the house is a grad student in computer science, and his parents had co-signed on the house so he could not, basically, they'd keep it while he was here, then sell it. And so that's exactly what happened. He basically lived here for rent-free by the time he sold it because the house had appreciated. And he had a buddy. I'd go to some computer science parties with him, and he had this buddy named Paul Boutin, if you ever find – not Paul Boutin. I'm telling you the wrong name. It's Paul Barton Davies. Paul Boutin was a wire editor. Sorry. So Paul Barton Davies was
right, Brit. Yes.
Oh, if you, yes, yeah. So yes. He comes up in the accounts, right? So Paul met him at a party, and Paul says, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna get out of the program because the PhD program because I'm gonna work for this guy named Jeff, and he's got this. We're gonna put our employees inside of book distributor warehouses, and they're gonna ship books from in there. So people will place orders, and I'm like, oh, that's never gonna work because at this point I knew about book distributors, having worked at a publisher. I knew some of the details of the book industry. Mm-hmm. I'm like, the book distributor, they are not. No, you're competing against them. They have channel conflicts. It's not gonna work. And then so some point not long after that, I don't even know if Jeff was in Seattle yet. I met up with Jeff through other mutual friends. We had lunch and hit it off, and I gave him advice. I know it's crazy, and he's a smart guy, and he knew what he was going to do, but I had an internet company that was a year old at that point, I think. Was it that long? It was something like that, but not that quite. We coincided at some point, but I was already running a company, and he was building one, so it was sort of hilarious. And so we would meet from time mm-hmm. to time and have lunch and chat about stuff, And immediately, like after Paul had told me what their model was, Jeff's like, "Oh no, we can't do that. Yeah, we're not going to do that. We're going to build a warehouse. We're going to start small. We can do some drop shipping where they'll ship on behalf, and then as we grow, you know, and whatever." And I was like, "Oh well, that makes more sense." And I got some early interviews with them when I was writing. So even before I was there, I wrote an InfoWorld feature about database access to, you know, the database thing again. And Jeff was willing to talk to me. Now I'm interviewing the CEO of Amazon. And it's like I say, 95 or early 96 for an article about the technical underpinnings of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And at some point I was getting dissatisfied with my little boutique business. I felt like it wasn't, I knew I could grow it, but I felt like I needed outside capital. I really wasn't secure. I was already working too hard. I wasn't secure in raising money, giving up control, going through that whole route. And then I wasn't confident about, I actually thought prices were going to collapse. There were a lot of people who are well-funded at that point, 95, 96 period, where they were working for free. You know, they would go to a major company and say, "We'll build a site for you for free because we're trying to build whatever." And the company would say, "Great, that sounds terrific. We like free." And you can't compete against free. So it was sort of dispiriting. And so we had we brought up new clients with less money. I had an employee for a bit. And we sort of hit a point where I thought, you know, this is not what I want to be spending my time doing. I need to get out of this. And I'd explored a merger with a design company, and that hadn't worked out. We decided there was a sort of a small programming company, this design firm and I, we'd spent some time talking about it and realized we just weren't the right fit for where the design company was probably the most robust. And they didn't want to do it. So Jeff, I'm out to lunch with Jeff, and Jeff said, "You know, if you ever want to come work for me, I'd hire you in a second." I'm like, "Oh, I want to come work for you." That sounds great. I bet I can work that out. He's like, "Oh, great. Well, come on over and interview." So I interviewed with several different people, including his wife, Mackenzie, who was deeply involved in kind of helping the stuff get set up in the early days. And they hired me. And I got the business transition and Scotty took it over and I got in that and moved on from there.
Well, and they hired you to do what exactly?
Well, it was interesting, and I can tell you this now. It was a while I couldn't talk about it because years literally because they didn't launch the program. But so Scott Lipsky, who went on to he was at that point, I want to say the vice president of business development. Was it vice president or something? Not vice president. He was the director of business development. He was a high level, maybe VP. He was a high level person. He reported to Jeff. There was not that much management infrastructure. There were 104 people when I joined. I think I was employee 105. We were all in the charming heroin district of Seattle,
right
across from the methadone clinic in the Columbia building, or not the Columbia building, it was called. It was not Columbia Tower, but I think it was literally the Columbia building, and had one floor and expanded to two while I was there of this crummy, crummy old building. And so Scott Lipsky later went on to be one of the founders of Avenue A, which Nick Hanauer was one of the founders of. And then Scott, so that got sold to Microsoft for, I think, $7 billion.
Right, advertising stuff, yeah.
Exactly, right. So Scott has a serial startup, well-placed person. He wound up staying about exactly a year. So he'd started a few months before I did, and they're hiring VPs like crazy. And he's like, look, there's two jobs. One job is catalog manager, and you're going to deal with like all of the information we have to associate with books and work with sources and data sources and improve that and work with this team and have a team of people who are entering, you know, scanning book covers and whatever. And the other is this thing that we haven't launched yet that is, I think they eventually called it Amazon Advantage, but it was, we're going to resell books directly for smaller publishers. Like, we're going to stock them and warehouse them and sell them on their behalf, and you're going to recruit people and whatever. That program didn't start, I think, for 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. I want to say. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad I didn't pick that one because I would have had to do something else. So I came in as catalog manager, and I was sort of replaced, but not. And the idea was that even for a company that small, they were highly siloed. So there was an editorial operation, warehouse, special orders, you know, there's sort of the programming people dealing with the orders, and different people own different pieces of things. And my job was, I don't think it was formed this way, but I made it my job, which was to work with everybody to get all of the information sort of in accord. So when you looked at a book page, I didn't exactly own the page, but I sort of did. So I wasn't setting pricing information, but I was pulling in source information about it. And, I worked out while I was there, my biggest accomplishment was that during a snowstorm, that year, snowstorm in 96, literally the town was shut down for like a week and a half, couldn't get into the office. And I spent 3 weeks in that period programming something that would take the limited set of data we had about each book, like reviews and so forth. And it built an association, which is now a commonplace thing, between works with different ISBNs. So essentially would lump things together, like all the Wizard of Oz's would be recognized that they were all the same work or close to the same work. And if we had a piece of data about one, we could cross-link it to another. This all sounds very trivial today. It was all incredibly difficult to do then because of the lack of computation power, even with what we were doing. So we went from having information on, you know, 100,000 pages to like 600,000 pages. And every bit of information you had helped increase sales. And so that was one of my main things. But I was basically working with data sources. I was working with Baker & Taylor, Ingram, and ultimately other companies who were creating, you know, had huge, constantly updated feeds of bibliographic information, and working to try to get that and then integrate that into what we did and accumulate more kinds of information about each book so that we could present a richer page. And that was my job.
So when you... back to what you were just describing about, you know, tying together related materials, like all of the Wizard of Oz stuff, is that sort of like laying the groundwork for, you know, what could be used for the recommendation engine later on and stuff like that?
Well, no, it's funny. That was kind of a separate thing. The recommendation engine, I was still there when they licensed it from a company's name, I forget. And the performance was terrible in the early days. And I never thought, by the time I left, they still hadn't gotten it working well enough. It just took forever. But that was an entirely different, I think they licensed it out of academia. These guys had spun off a company. So it was an entirely different effort.
I don't remember off the top of my head, but Shell remembered. So it's,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's right. Because there was, at that point, I mean, so I'll tell you. So here's the big problem with Amazon when I was there. The big problem was they needed more programmers and they couldn't hire them. and it wasn't a salary thing or a relocation thing. Amazon seemed like the most boring company in the world. Amazon seemed like, okay, you're going to go work for healthcare when all sorts of more exciting things were happening. There were, you know, people were writing software for the web. People were building applications for the desktop. There was all this stuff going on. And we'd say, look, you should come here and work. They're like, why? Well, like, we're not public yet. We can't guarantee anything, but this company could be big. And if so, you'll have stock and you're a programmer and you'll be working cutting edge e-commerce technology. And they're like, that doesn't sound very interesting at all. And so recruiting was a terrible problem. So by the time I left, I want to say there were only 12 programmers at Amazon in I left in May 1997.
No.
Maybe it was 12. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was 20 by then. It was very small. And frankly, without naming names, the person who was assigned to my group was not the right person. She was not able to, I think, see, I don't want to, it's not, it's like,
right,
I'm
right.
not trying to put anybody down. It's more like her, what she wanted to do with her life and the amount of hours she wanted to work, and even personality-wise, how she dealt with stress, this was not the right place for her. And it was difficult. And she stayed, I think, a couple years, you know, invested, and then went off to, I remember reading a story where she said, I make a turkey every week. And I was like, that is awesome. That's what you should be doing, because that is sort of accords with how you can deal with life. And but it meant that we really had a very difficult time getting anything done in my department, because I could not get her to do almost anything, basically. And there wasn't anyone else to turn to, and I could not get somebody else in, and we couldn't hire programmers for core e-commerce stuff fast enough, and the systems were getting mired. And to my recollection, I think Shell insisted on programming everything in C, and it was hard to find C programmers, young C programmers at that point, because everyone had shifted to C++ for objective object-oriented programming. And I remember, I may be wrong about that, I think it was all C. And so they were doing really incredible low-level stuff. That's the reason Amazon worked, is because they built their system, you know, one step above assembly is what it felt like, and that allowed them to optimize it like crazy. And Shell built Obidos, which is named after a place in Brazil, and it's the core engine. In the early days, you'd see a URL like amazon.com/exec/obidos, and then a bunch of stuff after it. And that system rewrote every page on the fly, which was insane in those days. And it rewrote it so that it could retain state before cookies. Amazon could retain state by appending a unique tracking ID to every single URL on every page. And cookies made that a lot easier. But without that system, they couldn't have persisted. And I, having built a year before a system for Peachbit Press, I realized just how difficult it was. I think cookies had started, we had cookies by 96, but I think there were still issues about persistence and how people accepted them and a bunch of other stuff and browser compatibility. So Amazon's, like, Obidos was this brilliant thing. It had to be written at a very, you know, in both a high-level language, like C is a high-level language, but also kind of close to the metal in that they had optimized like crazy. And they might have been writing even assembly for some of what they did. But this meant it was difficult to find the programmers who were gung-ho about the future and were well-versed enough to actually do this stuff. And we had a very ponderous process. For a long time, Jeff Bezos interviewed everybody. And then eventually they got him not interviewing customer service people. But we were interviewing for an administrative assistant for Scott, who was the VP, and Jeff called in from a plane to be part of our hiring meeting, which is an incredibly bad use of his time. And eventually, I think he got out of it. But he was the best kind of micromanager in that his decisions were often very good, but he was not focused in the right areas in those days. He was putting too much time into low-level stuff. And what we really needed is we needed like 30 programmers, and we had 10. After I left, they hired an entire consulting firm's worth of Oracle programmers, because Oracle was the database that those days. And I think it was like 8 guys. And they hired like another 10 people. So within a few months of when I left, I think they had 30 programmers, and everything changed. They were able to move forward much more quickly. But that was one of the reasons I left, is I felt like they could not actually pull off what they were going to do. And every day felt worse and worse.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Well, so I actually can completely understand that it would be hard if you're saying to programmers, you know, the web is taking off. Hey, come over here. What do you do? All we do is sell books. Okay, well, I can be inventing something entirely new over here. But so if there were only a handful of programmers and, you know, you join around employee 120 or so, what are most of the people there doing at that point?
Let's see. Well, a bunch of people in the warehouse, of course. And there is this thing. I feel comfortable saying it 20 years later. There's kind of a cronyism as one of the very early employees hired a bunch of people he'd gone to college with. Some of them were good, some were not. And I mean good in the sense of some people were like part of a team, worked well, could cope, could be professional, and some were just kind of not quite what they needed and eventually left or were pushed out. And but it meant that that had an impact on the early culture, and I'm sort of sorry for that. I think they didn't have a good hiring culture. They hired people they thought were really smart. They didn't have a process for dealing with people who didn't further the interests of the company as well as they should have. And I don't mean in a harsh way, like this person should be fired, but more like there was no system of correction for it. So anyway, that's sort of by the way. But the special orders department was a big thing, oddly enough, because we could order any book that was carried by Ingram or Baker and Taylor, which I think are still the two largest book distributors in the country. We had electronic connections to their system that were terrible, terrible systems. We were pushing them so hard, we were breaking things in their end. When I left, Amazon could not place orders, could actually not technically deliver orders into their system fast enough in a 24-hour period. So in 24 hours, they couldn't upload enough orders that affected the last 24 hours. They're falling behind because of the distributors' systems. They were using old mainframes and these weird old systems, and it was a dial-up thing. It was nuts. It was crazy. So the staff was some chunk in the warehouse, and I don't know the numbers. So that was probably a big hunk by then. There were a couple dozen people in special orders. And special orders were, we listed every book in print through any source that we had access to. And it was originally 1.1 million. And part of my thing was to pull in rare out of print and other stuff. And I got us to 2.5 million before I left. And of the 1.1 million, only about, I want to say 400,000 could be ordered through a major book distributor. So if you wanted to get a book from Springer Verlag, for instance, or Springer Verlag in America, you'd have to call them. Typically, they didn't have an electronic ordering system. This is 96, 97. So you call them. So there was a room full of people who, when special orders came in, they would be okay. You know, they'd develop it or fax it off and have to deal with the process. And Amazon's secret sauce that nobody ever got, and I have been saying this for 20 years, and Chris Anderson actually, I think he put some of this into The Long Tail. I think I'm quoted in there because I feel like it was missed, is in its early years. I don't know. How old are you? I don't know.
37.
Okay, so yep. You probably remember this. Do you remember having to special order books at a
Absolutely,
bookstore?
100%. Yeah. Or CDs, yeah. Sure, yeah.
Yeah, if you're 30, you probably wouldn't remember what that meant because you don't go into a bookstore.
Right.
You can still get special orders, but they're not called that anymore. They're like, oh, yeah, we'll ship it from our warehouse. So the inflection point for Amazon is, you're really just old enough for a little bit, remember, is pre-Amazon. You go to a bookstore, even Barnes & Noble, which at one point, and they changed this later, they had, I think, 250,000 unique titles in their superstores, something like that. It was a huge number. You go in and say, I need this book from 1992 that's still in print. Do you have it? And they're like, oh, and they tappity-tap. They pull up some kind of weird CD thing. Like, no, we can order. It'll be 2 or 3 weeks, and there's a $5, you know, the price is blah, it's full price, and there's a $5 processing thing. We'll call you when it's in, right? So that was the experience for anything but the most popular books that were widely in distribution. And there were certain categories, like Barnes & Noble had X hundred thousand. They could order within a day to 3 days another X hundred thousand, which was small. And then the largest part of books, the long tail that were very rarely ordered, but academic books and books that were still in print but were, you know, not in the front list, they're not backlist, were hard to get. Amazon's secret sauce was they hired a bunch of people and they had really good computer systems to divvy it out. And like so-and-so had all the publishers that began with A. So-and-so did Springer Verlag because it was a big thing and so forth. I had this call in January or February of you're jogging my memory so well. I'm remembering things I haven't talked about in 20 years. January, February 1997, I get a call from or I call Springer Verlag, so U.S. division. They have like 12,000 books in print and available in the U.S. And the guy says, because I want to get a direct feed. I'm working with all these publishers to get direct feeds of their stuff so we can be up to date, especially with bibliographic data, reviews, and background information, page counts, stuff that we can't always get accurately from distributors and other sources. And he said, God, I don't know who you guys are, but you rose from like nowhere to be like you're in the 95th percentile of people who buy from us. And I said, 6 months, we're probably going to be number one or two. He's like, huh. I don't know if that was true. But so we were in this middle of this interesting transition where all these book publishers and distributors were not geared up for rapid. The book industry was not that way. You would fax things. You might use some dial-in or weird online system even in 97 to order books, but it's kind of a one-at-a-time thing. And you'd have all this hand book selling, which still goes on to a lesser extent. Book reps travel around. They went to every bookstore. They'd go to the thousands of indies. They'd meet with Barnes & Noble and other chains, of which there were, I think, 8 or 9 at that point at high levels. And they'd be like, here's what's coming out. They'd recommend stuff. They'd talk. There'd be this sort of negotiation. They might give him deals. It was this whole, it was a marketplace. And if you're an indie bookstore, you might order like, okay, I want 10 of those. You talk to this person directly. They might even take the order down. They type it in their system. And it was crazy, right? So Amazon marks the change in that because special order books are super lucrative if you're efficient. So if you have a room of 25 people, all they do all day is order books that are special order. And you get an order for a textbook that's $80. Well, if you're Barnes & Noble and you don't order that very often, between staff time and shipping and whatever, your margin on that might be $20, maybe a little higher. I don't know, something like that. Amazon margin on that became like $40. You could make 50%, 40 or 50%, and you'd be selling at cover price, right? So Amazon was making bank on special orders, and people kept coming to us. And you'll notice some of the early coverage of Amazon when the publishers started to really take notice. Simon & Schuster's chief exec, I think it was, said maybe the next year, 98, I think he said this then, he said, Amazon has sold at least one copy of every book in our backlist in the last year, and it's increasing. And that was the thing. So Amazon not only sold the front list, which was less lucrative, and they started in this, you know, discounting battle with Barnes & Noble, but they could make money off it before they did the super deep, you know, 40% off. 20, 30% off, you could still make money, or 10, 20, 30% off. You could still make money. Mm-hmm. The publishing industry, which you may know, and I think this has changed a little bit. It used to be all books could be returned in good condition for full refund. Shipping was free from the publisher, but not back for if you ordered above a certain volume, and it wasn't very high. Books were discounted at typically 50 to 55% off cover if ordered in sufficient quantity directly. And distributors would typically offer a 40% discount off cover for most books. And some books were short discount where you got 20% off. These are the more obscure titles. Amazon was ordering all of these books directly from the publishers and within a very short time in sufficient quantity to get A, free shipping, B, fully returnable, which was great,
right,
and C, 55% off. So suddenly, you know, so let's say Barnes & Noble is buying it at 20 off. Amazon's buying it 50 at 5 off. Makes it easier. And they're like, oh, yeah, we can get that to you in 3 to 5 days. And Barnes & Noble says, come back in a couple weeks. We might have it in. We'll call you. We don't know. So that was a little bit of the secret sauce. And it was a surprising – I mean, when we had 100 people, I think a dozen people were on it. And when it was 200 people in the company, I think 2 dozen people were on that. And it drove – at that time, there was no drive towards profitability. But it certainly drove – revenue, and it drew this experience that every book that was listed, you could get essentially with a click, even before the one click, you'd say, yeah, I want this. And then it would show up within anything from a couple days to, you know, a couple weeks, and there was no hassle. So everybody who was interested in books that they couldn't otherwise get easily, now started to turn very large numbers to Amazon. And we saw it because we could see the order volume for special orders increasing.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, this idea that it wasn't that Amazon, like doing commerce on the web wasn't really the thing that excited people. It was this whole long tail being the secret sauce sort of thing. And the ability to it's the world that we take for granted now. Like, any title, anything that you want, you should be able to get it instantaneously. Amazon was that first aha, this is possible sort of thing.
Right, and they had this advantage, which was the big five publishers, which I think are big four now, or is it big six and big five anyway? Well, whatever, the biggest, you know, let's say 90% of the new books sold in the country were by a few people. So there is the big head advantage of only having to go to a certain place. So the long tail story is often told that there's an advantage to aggregation, but the advantage is rarely to the person selling. And this is a point that I think Chris did put in the long tail book, because I don't know if I pushed it or maybe followed up later, but this is a point I've made, is that Amazon makes money selling a million different books. The publishers don't necessarily make money by selling one copy of their book a year to Amazon. I mean, that's great. They're selling a copy they wouldn't have otherwise, but it's better for Amazon than it is for the publisher in some levels. The publisher is getting incremental, but Amazon gets the advantage of aggregation. So in the book industry, the advantage to Amazon was every big publisher had its own long tail, and the long tail was the backlist. And they keep these copies, sometimes keep them in print, or at least have the back stock available, and eventually, you know, and then eventually remainder stuff. And so what Amazon did is they were able to get, because so few publishers dominated the industry, they had the big win of being able to order from the same place, like five places, basically, when they started to do direct and bypass distributors for the big publishers. They go to these, you know, a small number of sources and be able to source hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of the most popular books, including the most popular backlist. So there was a long tail and big head within the larger thing that Amazon was doing. So they were able to make profit off that. And then because of the special order system, they were able to make profit off dealing with thousands of smaller publishers. And then when they got big enough, they could set terms for the publishers and say, look, we're ordering so much from you. No one else is ordering this much. We know it. You should give us better terms. And they could get those. And the publishers were typically happy because at that point, because they were selling stuff they'd never sold before. So Amazon like mastered multiple long tails, I think, because no one was in place to do it. And once they'd done that, they sort of overcame. They had enough volume and enough margin that it overcame a lot of the friction that had prevented this from happening before.
Let me ask you, and by asking this, I'll acknowledge that you probably might not have been privy to these sorts of things, but when you were there, did you get a sense that the idea was always to move to everything and that books were just a test case initially?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, so I used to go out. This is like the humble brag thing. I used to go out to lunch with Jeff all the time. But it's true. It's like a small company. I knew him. We were sort of buddies. We weren't like good friends or anything. You know, he came over to the house once and so forth. But we weren't like, you know, close or anything. But we trusted each other. And because I came in from another company and I'd been, I guess this is right. I wasn't kind. I just gave of my time to him when they were starting up. And not that he necessarily needed it, but he asked for it. And so I think there was a little bit of like sort of shared, like, okay, well, I'm working for you now, but it wasn't, you know, eventually I started feeling like more like an employee when it got bigger. But so I heard a lot of the plans. Nothing was that secret per se. Most of the stuff that seemed like it might have been secret was stuff that people wouldn't believe that Amazon would ever do. They didn't think they were ever going to succeed. So how would they succeed at another thing? So there were plans before I left. There was extensive planning about essentially getting into anything that could be shipped, any kind of media that could be shipped. And I forget if the DVD efforts had already launched by then. There was always talk about being able to ship things for other people, if that made sense. And that turned into a program, you know, both for books and then ultimately everything.
Right,
in
right.
In fact, what's great is I've used Amazon Fulfillment by Amazon and their multi-channel fulfillment for a book that I did last year for the magazine. And so I've actually gotten the benefit of their really great, their horrible IT side, but really great logistics side of doing fulfillment. But I don't think there was never like web services. I think is a huge part of what Amazon is going to wind up doing, and they do it very well. And that was not discussed, although we'd hired a guy just before I left who I had long conversations with about, he wanted to figure out how to scale operations. And because he knew it was big already, even things like image storage, like we had hundreds of megabytes of images stored for book covers, and we were doing the math, and he's like, well, we need to have terabytes, and we can't afford terabytes, so how are we going to do that? Like, what's the scale? It's like, oh, well, this is a good question. And so they were already having to deal, even when I left, with scaling computer resources at a level that almost nobody was doing outside of like oil companies, people, or space, like where they were dealing with massive data sets. They were doing stuff. When I got there, Amazon was running more transactions per second through their Oracle database than any other customer of Oracle. And it just got worse, right? And so Oracle's kernel for its database was not set up for massive transaction processing. I would argue that Amazon is one of the reasons that Oracle did so well, is because Oracle had to fix things to meet Amazon's needs, and that was not their clientele at the time. Their clientele was much more ponderous. So I would say, like, web services, I think the need to build massive data centers was already on the horizon, but I don't think the web services part. The idea of getting into digital downloads, that was always talked about, but everyone assumed it was really far away because nothing was legal at that point. And, you know, I was pre iTunes and all that too. I think when I left, I thought they would expand to become not an everything store, but like a really good purveyor of any kind of media thing you wanted in any format and maybe into some related stuff. But I never got the sense of the scope of what would eventually open it up to
like
be.
Garden tools and televisions and stuff, right?
Yeah, I sort of, because when they got into that, they did it really badly the first time. They hired the guy from Black & Decker, and he, among other things, he was commuting to Boston to be with his kids every week when he was the president of Amazon, which was revealed at some point after he left that he's a great father. He was divorced and a great father, but he was flying to the East Coast every week while running the startup, which is tricky. And he suggested, and they hired a bunch of old Walmart people, and they opened warehouses, and they had to close a bunch of them in the late 1990s, early 2000 when the crash happened, because they weren't ready for what they were doing. Then they went back and built everything out correctly, but they kind of went nuts in carrying too many things. The joke about the box of nails, the 50-pound box of nails that they're selling with like $1 shipping, and the selling kitty litter and all that. Not what killed pets.com also was not good for Amazon. And it took them a long time, I think, until, you know, a few years after the .com crash to figure out how they could actually do that stuff efficiently, because they'd wasted so much money and they could have been cleverer. They didn't need to climb that growth curve because it wasn't profitable, and it ultimately set them back years. Mm-hmm. But I would say I don't remember Jeff even talking about it at those stages. I mean, he said, the thing I recall is in 96, I guess, I was at an orientation, I think sitting in for customer service people, and he's talking about the future. And he had said something in the order, you know, by 2001, we're going to have, you know, 8,000 employees, and we'll be selling, you know, we'll be a $1 billion company or something. I mean, it was some range like that. And I was like, yeah, it seems plausible. Like, where the rate of growth and everything that's going on, this all seems reasonable. But it was all still centered around, I would say, media, whether it might be digital in the future or not.
I had heard, or I thought I had heard, and then I was unable to find it in my research, that you said when you left, you felt like you left because you thought that Amazon was a sinking ship.
sinking.
Right, sinking. Okay. What was the experience at the time that made you feel that way? And obviously, it probably was, but they turned the ship around. But what was going on that made you feel that way?
Well, I felt like things were sort of coming unhinged. So we had I was good friends with they'd hired Rhodes Scholars by the score. They hired them whenever they could. They had this problem, which was Amazon had the not invented here problem. And they had the we don't care about your experience problem, and we're just going to hire smart people problem, which persists in Silicon Valley and other companies to this day, although a little less, I think. They hired people they thought were smart and capable and flexible. And they didn't hire people with any experience, and so they would recapitulate the problems of industries. And they would approach things from the standpoint of what people knew, as opposed to what was probably the best course. And so there was a lot of, it wasn't arrogance, but it was a lot of, so Scott Lipsky, the guy I worked for, he came from Barnes & Noble. He was the CTO of Barnes & Noble College and Textbook Division, which was a huge part of Barnes & Noble. And he knew a bazillion things and literally could not get any of the stuff he knew built into what we were doing, which was crazy. He, at one point, you've probably heard that the early customer system was you had to learn Unix.
Right,
you learn some Unix and like Emacs or something to answer customer support mail. Well, Scott, in a weekend, built a Visual Basic front end that would actually be a totally GUI-operated thing, and he was told that they would never deploy that. it would have allowed no training. You basically could have sat down and started doing it. Just train on what emails are appropriate and be monitored for that. And they're like, no, no, no. We only want people who are smart enough because we want to bring these people up. And, you know, this is our culture. Everyone comes. It's ridiculous. You can't scale on that. So that attitude was pervasive. Jeff being involved in the hiring meetings was absurd. It was starting to taper off. But, I mean, really, for low-level positions, it was a waste of his time. He was on the road because they were working towards the IPO. So he's doing the road show. We were having more and more technical problems. We couldn't scale. The Oracle kernel was getting overwhelmed. We had people sleeping in the office, some of the programmers, because to get work done. We couldn't get orders into the distributor systems as fast as we were getting them, which was problematic and was getting worse. I felt like they'd made some bad, I don't want to name names, they made some bad hires at higher levels, several of whom left within a year or a little bit longer, and I was very unhappy. I didn't want a promotion. I wasn't of the level. I didn't have business or other experience. I was very happy as like a manager reporting to a VP. I was very happy with my position. I was unable to get the staff I needed. We were falling behind in things. They were resistant to supporting. There was a big split between hourly and salaried workers, and I was fighting hard on behalf of my staff. Eventually, one of the things I count as a giant accomplishment is I and a few other people managed to, not exactly shame, but force the management to give hourly workers a stock grant. They didn't get a stock grant, you know, and so that meant literally for some of those people, that turned into hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, I know people who bought houses because of that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I will take, you know, my 5% credit of being one of the voices saying this is unfair and unreasonable to these people, because the difference between someone here is making, you know, $10 an hour working for me and me is not. There's not, that's just, it's like discrimination practically. So that was going on. I wasn't happy. The warehouse was not OSHA compliant. I was not happy with how the warehouses were run. I had lost my confidence. And so the big thing that happened, though, I think the one that put me over was two things. One was Jeff had asked me to expand the catalog. And so I did this whole thing getting information from the Library of Congress, and we integrated it into the database. It's a big project. And I was dispirited after it because I could not get, despite being given direct authority by Jeff on this project, despite his backing, I could not get the various silos to do what I needed to do because they were all overwhelmed with other things. Or they said, we're not going to do that. It's not important to us. I'm like, supporting to Jeff? They're like, we don't care. And he was on the road and whatever. So eventually another person who is part of this, I want to say it wasn't a cabal. He was great. He was a super competent guy, but he was part of this group of college friends. I forget who Jeff hired in. He was fantastic and he took it over. And I was delighted, and took him a while to get everything in place, but he managed to get it all going. But I felt like that was a black cloud over me. Like, I didn't want to stay there after that, and I didn't feel like there was any room for advancement. I felt I would get pushed down lower and lower and have less and less interesting things to do. And simultaneously, I met the woman who I've now been married to and been with for since 1997. And I realized there was not enough time to have a startup job and develop a relationship with someone who I was already in love with. So I thought, you know, this is it. There's no room at this company. I don't want to work this hard anymore for what I'm getting. I don't care about the stock. I'm in love and I'm sick of it. And I am out of here. I'm going to have two bottles of beer and pull the ripcord and slide down the evacuation slide. So it wasn't that extreme. It was more like, and in fact, obviously, and the other thing is, my boss, Scott, he was also not that happy, I find, later, because he left exactly on his one-year anniversary, like 3 months later. And he tried to talk me into staying, but I was not happy working for him because I felt like he was not happy with the authority he had at that point. He was sort of getting frozen out, too. So it was time to go. And I left with, friends with everybody. And at some point, Jeff was on the road. He called and said, I bet there's no way I can talk you out of this, right? And I said, no, I think I'm ready to move on, and I'm worn out, and this isn't the place. He's like, that's great, and thanks, you know, sort of essentially, thanks for being here. And I'm like, it was terrific, and I have no regrets, and whatever. So then I left. And I left thinking that I was concerned. And I'd passed on, I think I probably wrote him a memo. I wrote people memos before I left. Mm-hmm. Like, is this company going to be standing in a month or 2 months? And I was highly dubious. And I wouldn't have stayed if I was confident. I was going to leave anyway. But I also thought, I don't need to be here in the wreckage. I want to get my last paycheck. I don't want to be associated with the company that goes down. But I was also totally ready to go. And after I left, like, they hired a ton of programmers. They revamped stuff. They changed things. Some people left who were obstructionists. They hired in some new great people, some of whom I think were there for 15 years or longer. And they turned the ship around. And they managed to get everything settled and become the company they are today. So in the end, I have no regrets. Like, and I say this often. My wife has this joke. She's like, I know exactly how much I'm worth to you because you walked away. I'd invest, and I walked away from probably, if I'd stayed 5 years, I probably could have, you know, sold the stock for $5 to $10 million if I'd stayed the whole time. But I'd say a year, it might have been a couple $1 million bucks. And I don't care. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I was, I'm glad I left when I did. I'm glad I'm still with my partner, and I'm not sorry that Amazon did well. I'm glad they did. I wish they'd be less evil these days, but I'm not sorry that they became a going concern and did what they did.
Well, you know, they the question I would have would be, you know, they had a near-death experience after the bubble burst as well. So, yeah. You know, but they have succeeded, wildly successful. In retrospect, this is sort of a wide-open question, but in retrospect, was there anything that you could see either in Jeff or in the company and the culture and the people that you could say, you know what, I bet that's why they have succeeded?
He is, let's see. So the thing about Jeff, when I worked with him and knew him, and I feel like he's changed some. Like, I feel, I'll start at the far end, which is, I feel like there's a fundamental unkindness about Amazon now that does not, I don't associate with him, certainly not with, with Mackenzie, who set some of the culture in the beginning, his wife, or some of the really early people who are wonderful, interesting, varied people. Oh my God, what an incredible group of people they did get together, though. I mean, it was, you know, it was like college plus, in terms of like the creative thinking and intelligence and everything else. I feel like there's an unkindness about Amazon as the company's gotten bigger, that they make decisions that are just unnecessarily cruel to people, that are unnecessarily aggressive. And it must be set from the top. And it makes me feel bad because I don't think he was that person. What I thought about him back then is that he had a remarkable ability to contain a huge number of different things in his mind at once and proceed towards many goals simultaneously without losing sight of the details. And that hung him up in the sense that he stayed involved for too long with the details. But he was right. He wasn't a micromanager who drove you nuts because he was always wrong or changing things. He was a micromanager who you're like, oh, you shouldn't be involved in this, but what you're doing is actually a good decision. We weren't all trained in making decisions as well as he was. And, you know, and eventually he had to let go of some of that and maybe with better or worse results. I'm not sure that the culture in those days encouraged people to make the right kinds of decisions on their own because it was such a hassle, and he did intervene a lot. I mean, he and I spent weeks, not, you know, 120 hours, but we spent weeks going back and forth over the language that it would explain different shipping statuses about books that were in stock, like what we called in stock, because we did not have, we only had a little bit in the warehouse at that time. We're stocking very little until after I left. So it was what could be shipped from which warehouse, from which distributor, because we knew which warehouses things were in and where they were going to wind up from. What we were calling hard to find books was my term for what's in the industry is called out of print, or OOP, OOP. And we decided to call them hard to find because it was a mixture of books that weren't in distributor catalogs, but might or might not have been in print, but we knew we'd have to work harder for them. So we spent, say, weeks, and I would draft something, he'd look at it, he'd be out of town, he'd come back, he'd look at that, we'd make changes, and I was very satisfied. The final language was good, and I think it was up on the site for years. My code ran for years to generate the cross-reference stuff, and that was fun to see after the fact. But I think Jeff just had a remarkable big picture, little picture ability. And I think, I got to say, I think he was terrible at hiring at one level and good at another. So he hired the mix of people, hired a lot of really great people and some really people who were not aligned to his interests, let's say, people who may be great in other contexts. There was one person hired, I don't want to give details because then I would get myself in trouble. But one person hired who, not after I was there for a little while, was left of her own accord or his own accord at that point. And, it was really clear for months that it wasn't a good fit, and it was just hard. Microsoft has this problem too. It used to in the past of getting rid of people who just aren't the right person. Either they're incompetent, or they're not doing their job. You know, they're not doing the job that needs to be done, and they had a great difficulty with it. And I think Amazon had that problem too. So I feel like its growth, oddly, was hampered by bringing in the wrong people and listening to them for too long. And you know, Mike Daisy's whole 21 dog years doing time at Amazon.com. His whole book and show was a bit about the MBAification of Amazon, where people came in and made terrible, terrible decisions for reasons that didn't make sense. And all those decisions eventually worked out poorly, and you know, so it wasn't good. So I think they had to have some kind of coming to Jesus moment after the .com crash. And since then, despite the issues with not being able to produce a consistent profit, they certainly have operationally generally done very well. And you know, again, my problem with Amazon today is I think the origins of not caring about warehouse workers and hourly people when I was there, of treating them poorly, I would say, in relative terms, relative to how they should be treated as human beings and workers. I think I see that as a through line. I think the fact that they were willing to run warehouses in the summer without air conditioning until they got so many complaints and maybe even fines. I don't know. I don't think they got fined. And then they're finally like, oh, we have air conditioning everywhere. I'm like, well, how many years were you running those where it's 101 degrees in there? Why the process you read about where they essentially grind their warehouse workers into dust, which would never be allowed in Europe. And there's actually lawsuits in Europe about what Amazon's doing relative to unions and things. Like, I find that a through line, and it's unfortunate. Because they should be better than that, you know.
And do you mean it bleeding into now their business practices in terms of entering markets and behaving in markets as well?
I think so. I'm disappointed. Like, I believe that capitalism is the best system we've had so far for the least misery, and it's not a great system for it. And maybe socialism is better. So, I mean, this is getting a political thought, but, like, I don't know. Like, I'm not sure I'm confident about any of this, but I guess I feel like when I look at every other system in the world, probably capitalism is the least bad. And so I don't come at the standpoint that says companies shouldn't make money, they shouldn't be aggressive. But I think – so Costco is the great example here in Seattle. We've got Costco, we've got Amazon. Costco has treated its workers well from its founding. The management is not overpaid. They really strive for actual value for their shareholders and for their customers, and they seem to achieve it. They're very well regarded. They offered health care early on to people who weren't working very many hours. Like, they're sort of an anti-Walmart, or way Walmart at least used to be. It's changed a little bit. Costco, I think they resisted unionization is the only thing you could say about them, but they were sort of like a very good player, and it's for the kind of job it is. It's a very good job. And Amazon, I feel like, is almost on the other side, where, like, their interest seems to be entirely focused at this point into winning at all costs, into scorching the earth, making sure there's no room for competitors, and not even being kind to suppliers and so forth. The whole author thing, where they're trying to persuade authors that their publishers are against them, and playing different, you know, trying to get readers to be involved in, like, fighting a battle that's really about, you know, profit margins and whatever that should be fought behind closed doors and worked out. You know, not selling the books, Hachette's books, like, all this stuff, it's bullying, and it doesn't further their interests. It certainly did not make them more money. In the long term, it's not a good strategy for them to continue to capture what they need to as a company, is my take. I mean, it's not that even when they win, I feel like they lose, right? It's one thing when you're fighting Barnes & Noble, which was kind of had a lot of issues. And you could say Barnes & Noble wasn't evil, but they were, I don't know, they were aggressive about pricing and whatever. There are all kinds of things Barnes & Noble did. And they used to be sort of the bad guys, right? The big chain store, right? That was whatever.
The big bad You've Got Mail chain store that killed Meg Ryan's little bookshop and things like that, yeah.
Yeah. The good news is that independent bookstores apparently I don't know if they're on the rise, but they sort of hit, they did not all go out of business, right? They hit a low point, and I think it stayed there and grown a bit because people want a genuine experience, and bookstores transformed. It's possible Amazon is a bubble in terms of media, and eventually it will be a digital media and web services company and ship very little physical items, but it's hard to know. But it's not that I expect companies to be kind. It's that I expect a company like Amazon, with an orientation towards customers and their, you know, their stated goal to serve their customers, should be able to treat their workers with respect and dignity at every level. And I think there was always, I'm going to say there was an elitism. I'm a Yale graduate, and I wasn't hired because I went to Yale, though I don't think it hurt, that's for sure. Jeff was went to Princeton. There were a lot of Ivies, people at all levels there. And there definitely was that split between hourly and salary was part of it. There was a lot of, I want to say, putting one's nose in the air about things about pedigree and degrees and companies worked for. And it wasn't oppressive because I was on the top side of it, I think. But I feel like that is still that kind of thing, that workers are disposable, interchangeable. Amazon is putting more robots for efficiency into their warehouse, which they should, absolutely should. But I think the way they treat workers makes me feel like they think robots and people are the same thing.
Well, you know,
and it bothers me.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Just one more question, because you made me think of it. When I started working on the Amazon end of this, I was operating on this basic assumption that I feel like, you know, most investors have been operating on, that essentially the reason that Amazon has been able to get away without making profits for all these years is that everyone is convinced they're the second coming of Walmart. And Walmart, like Microsoft, was that one big stock that got away that, man, if you had just gotten in early on, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I read, you know, the Sam Walton book. I read books on Sam Walton and stuff, because I was hunting for these little these nuggets that were like, okay, I can see where Jeff got this idea from Sam and things like that. But so you saying that about the workers and things like that, because obviously that Walmart's also a company that's accused of being the same thing. And I realize you might not be qualified to even answer this, and it's wide open, but do you feel like maybe that is maybe culturally or as a business model, something that is something that maybe he took from Walmart?
I think it's accidental, I have to say, because I never saw Jeff behave in any way, and nor really any of the people who were directly responsible to him behave in any way that implied that workers were different classes or elitism or anything like that. But I think it's a lack of caring about it. It's a lack of thinking about that part of the situation. I think if Jeff spent a month working in one of his warehouses, he would be extremely ill. You know, like, I think he would not actually be able to do it. I don't mean that like he's a weak person, but I mean, like, I think most people, I don't understand how people can work in the warehouses based on multiple reports, not, you know, some people getting jobs and writing about it for publications, and just the reports that come out in Glassdoor, you can read about it, things like that. Is I just think Amazon has this driven culture. They pretend they're a startup still, and they treat, maybe that's the crux of it, is they believe that everyone should be in and on their side within the company, even if they don't get the benefits. So, you know, managers in the warehouses are getting stock and other stuff and bonuses, and the people who work for them are getting crap all. They're getting their hourly wage, which isn't great. And I just feel like there's a way where you could be treating people, you could, not that everyone, not, I mean, yes, a warehouse needs to have performance goals, they need to be efficient, they need to have good workers, but there's also this loyalty that I feel is absent. As people get churned up and fired when they stop meeting their goals, you know, when they've sort of, when they've worn them out. And I would love to know what the multi-year employment history is of people. The histogram is probably fascinating for Amazon warehouses, but I don't think it's intentional. I don't think Jeff is reported to be a libertarian. I never heard him talk anything about his political ideas when I was around him. And libertarianism doesn't mean you're cruel. It means that everyone's making their own choices, right? And so everyone's their own actor. I mean, there's a little Ayn Rand in there too, I'm sure. But it's if you're informed party with your own volition and agency making your own choices, then you've made the choice in your life that's led you to having a warehouse job. So this is your problem, right? And I feel like that comes through a bit. Maybe I'm misguided, but I don't think that it was an emulation of Walmart. I don't think there's a specific idea. They needed a lot of low-paid workers to make their system go. I just think it's they just feel like they're going to do what makes sense for the business. And but I would say that, like, I would be like, could Jeff Bezos work a month in his warehouse in like the Kentucky one that was not air conditioned? I don't know if he pulled up. You know, this is the problem, the farmhand problem. We have this in Washington State, is that there's this thing about, you hear this all the time, is that the people who come up, the campesinos and so forth, who come up, whether they're legal or not, they will work as hard as they need to work, because that's what they do and that's what they have to do in order to stay alive and take for the care of their family. And the farmers will talk about, ranchers, whatever, they'll talk about, you know, we hired people who are from here, who are, you know, they've done farm work before and they last a half a day and they go home. You know, even no matter what wage we're paying, when they can't get the people they need because of immigration crackdowns and whatever. And I feel like there's a little bit of that, like, well, if people are capable of working that hard, then we'll just find more and more people who can. And we're not going to worry about what the impact is on them, because eventually they won't be our employee anymore and it's not our problem. That's kind of harsh, but it's true.
Yeah.
I have a beautiful story I could tell, though, that would
excellent.
Cheer you up.
Excellent, right? Excellent.
I think it's beautiful. It has aspects of sadness in it, though. Well, there's a death in it, but I should tell anyway. So before I left Amazon, I'd gotten this out-of-print book program started, and we needed to check in our systems because we didn't have a way to record and stock prices for things that were not new books being sold through distributors and other sources. So we did one test. At a housemate at the time, my landlord, who has the housemate, he'd sold the house to me and moved on. I'd gotten another roommate in. And she said, oh, there's this book I've always loved, and I haven't been able to find a copy of it. It's called Fisher's Hornpipe. It's by Todd McEwen. I'd love to get a copy of that. And it came out, I'm looking it up, came out March 1983. And this is not, you know, so it's a hard-to-find book. I think it was even out of print at that point. So I plugged that in the system, and the very first book ordered at Amazon as a used or out of print book was Fisher's Hornpipe. So the sad part is I quit my job at Amazon in April of 97. And I think my last day was May 2nd. And I think it was the next night that roommate died. She was killed in a motorcycle accident. And that, you know, it's a rough time for everybody involved. I didn't know her as well as some of my friends. She was a friend of a friend. But I had this sort of memory of like, I kept the book. I think her family gave it to me. So I have Fisher's Hornpipe somewhere in the house. Made me appreciate even more the decision I'd made that I was going to go and do something more meaningful with my life and not be unhappy and stay with this person I'd met. And like that. So that's the first out of print book story for Amazon.
Well, Glenn, thank you for not only remembering all that great Amazon stuff, but being willing to do some deep thinking about it too.
Thank you very much. You've now, I some of these things I haven't thought about in 20 years. So now I'll remember everything. It'll be like a recovered memories.
Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice. There's plenty more great internet history where that came from. And if you're a longtime listener, then you know what to do to help us out. Rate and review us on iTunes. Because iTunes gives credit to reviews and ratings, and the more great reviews we get, the more people will discover us. As always, there's more info on our website, www.internethistorypodcast.com. The show's Twitter handle is @NetHistoryPod, and my personal Twitter is @BrianMCC. Thanks for listening.